John Gotti was quoted when he was sent to prison is that they're going to miss John Gotti. And there's an element of truth to that. You know, there were certain things you didn't do. There was, you know, code. And now there doesn't appear to be any rule. You know, you didn't hit a cop, you didn't hit a journalist, you know, you shut up. But that's all gone. That's a lost world.
I'm Nicola Tallant. And you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs, and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe.
They were once the most powerful force in America, bigger than General Motors and with a finger in every pie from politics to prostitution. But what has become of the mafia and its old school criminal code? Is it a dying force? Has the mafia peaked? Or has it a comfortable plateau in a new world order where stringent racketeering laws keeps all criminality at bay? Today, I'm talking to Toronto Sun mafia expert and former New York Post crime correspondent Brad Hunter about the past and about the future of the legendary Cosa Nostra. This is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. This much, does the mafia still exist today in, you know, the significant cities, New York, Chicago, Philadelphia? Is it still actually there, or is it been completely wiped out?
Well, it's there, but it's greatly diminished. Whereas, you know, I was speaking with George Anastasia, longtime mob reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he said, you know, there used to be 80 guys and hundreds of associates, 80 made men and hundreds of associates. And now there's about 25 and he can count them, you know, and as he noted that if he can count them, so can the cops.
Yeah. And also, so can anybody who's looking to move in on their turf and their territory, younger, presumably more violent gangs. When you talk about them now, we just kind of think of those old black and white pictures. I'm sure there's younger guys and it's come down the generations, all right. But who is left and what are they kind of doing now? Let's take New York, really, as the big capital of what was the stronghold of the mafia.
Well, if you think of the mafia as, you know, at one point, let's dial back the clock, as like a giant industrial sort of company. They had their hands in trucking, in unions, in manufacturing, along with the regular sort of vices like gambling and prostitution and drugs and that sort of thing. So it was this all-encompassing thing. Well, they've lost the labor unions. They don't have that, you know, anymore. They've lost trucking by and large. So it's a much smaller mafia concentrated on smaller things. And because, you know, they've also taken a hit because, you know, gambling's been legalized, as has cannabis in many U.S. jurisdictions and, you know, indeed in Canada as well. And, you know, we've seen, you know, just that they're just not the players they were. I mean, as Sammy the Bull Gravano, legendary mob hitman, former Gambino underboss, you know, told me, he said, these guys don't even kill anymore.
I have to say, I loved your interview with him because, before I kind of realized that he is, like, he was the ultimate snitch who became, as only in modern times this can happen, and really as only in America this can happen, he's become a kind of podcast star, you know. So he's former mafioso, he gives up all his buddies, all the made men, he does the ultimate, he breaks Omerta, and he lives, and then he becomes this podcast star, and you've interviewed him. I became interested in him because during those US Senate hearings dating back, are they to the 70s or 80s? He gives evidence and he talks about boxing and how the US mafia, the New York mafia, saw boxing as a way to launder their money. And it echoed a lot for me with modern criminality, with the Kinahan organization. Were they doing similar? Is there ever an original idea as such? But tell me a little bit about him, because he is like, he's a fascinating character.
Oh, he's, and you know, it's funny. Yeah, he is a very fascinating, very funny guy, extremely bright man. He was a guy who grew up in Brooklyn, and, you know, at that time, you know, if you had trouble reading and things like that, you're automatically, you know, considered by educators and teachers as stupid. Well, it was dyslexia, right? And in fact, you know, he was a guy who probably, you know, if he'd had that taken care of and had a few more advantages, would be running a Fortune 500 company. He was a guy, you know, he was a devotee of the mafia. He fell into it, you know, and he was a guy who was very, very low key. Barely anyone had heard of him, like outside that, you know, the criminal underworld, until he was made underboss by John Gotti, underboss of the Gambino crime family. He was extremely successful. He controlled most of the concrete poured in New York City. You know, he looked at any time that, you know, he had to kill, he looked at it as business. It wasn't something he took pleasure in. It wasn't, you know, anything like that. And so what happened was, is he became Gotti's underboss. Now, you know, we know now that John Gotti was a terrible mob boss. You know, he was, you know, blowing $200,000 a weekend on gambling on football and things. So he was a degenerate gambler. And so, of course, Sammy was a true believer. Now, he you know, never would have, you know, turned cooperating witness, as he prefers, to rat, canary, or stool pigeon. Except that, you know, the FBI get Gotti on tape, and he's saying, and, you know, Gotti's careless as hell, and the people around him are careless as hell. So we're saying, well, you know, we'll stitch up Sammy. Sammy will take the fall on this. And that wasn't a meal that Sammy was going to take. And, you know, the feds played this for him, and he said, okay. And he flipped. And, you know, sent Gotti and countless others to prison. But the interesting thing about that, Nicola, is that, you know, I said, you know, when you were doing time, or, you know, were you ever really, you know, were you looking over your shoulder? And initially, yes. But he said that, you know, messages were sent to him that a lot of other mob bosses and mobsters saw Gotti going to jail as a good thing, because he just drew so much heat, right? He's in the tabloids every day, flashing the $1 million pinky ring and wearing bespoke suits and whatnot, and going out to nightclubs. And, you know, the model mob boss is somebody like the late Carlo Gambino, who's the nice old man who lives down the street and is very quiet and drives a modest car. That's your ideal mob boss.
So that's funny, because, and really, I suppose, to understand the mafia and the evolution of it, it probably started with Al Capone in Chicago and with Prohibition. And there was opportunities there for smuggling. And of course, most of the mafia, you have to be Italian, I think, to be made a made man. You cannot be of any other origin. The mafia, they came from Sicily, where they had been born, up in the hills, where there was this code of honor, omerta, you do not talk, you stick together. There was this blood bonds, and it was like them against the rest of America. And of course, by the time Vegas was built, and you had, you know, the Chicago outfits, and you had the Philadelphia outfits, the New York outfits, they'd become really, really rich, wealthy, poured their money into concrete, as you say, built half of New York. the likes of Gambino, is he, you say he never had any connections and he wasn't known until he becomes this underboss. Is he just coming from the Italian community, or are these guys at his stage, you're talking really the 70s, are they second generation then in New York, or was Gambino and Gotti the first generation of the mafia there?
They're second generation, and I mean, that's sort of second, maybe third. And that's sort of the problem that the mob has run into. You know, again, George Anastasia and I were talking about it, and it was that, you know, previously, and I found this from you know, made men that I've interviewed over the years and different things, is they didn't, it was sort of a means for some of the old timers that came over and everything like that. You know, it was a way of life. But, you know, as the years dial on and you're seeing the American dream in front of you, you're thinking, do I want my son to go into this and put a target on his back? No, you want to, you use your ill-gotten gains to send them to Harvard, to, you know, become a doctor, an engineer, a lawyer, right? So what happens is that the people going into it, you know, increasingly, you know, particularly now, are knuckleheads. And you know, I mean...
So in other words, the families and those five families of New York who ultimately went to war against one another, and ultimately the U.S. authorities, the New York authorities, decided they'd become too powerful and they had to crack down on them. But they have almost, over the generations and moving forward to now, become gentrified almost.
No, that's quite right. Much like the late lamented Times Square of the 70s. They have become gentrified. They're more into, you know, white collar crime. As Sammy said, they don't kill anymore. You know, they don't have Vegas anymore. So they and gambling's legalized, but they're still into loan sharking and different things like that. And they're still into drugs as well, which, you know, drugs were once forbidden because of the stiff penalties and that, you know, anyone connected with you would face. So, you know, a mob soldier starts selling heroin on the side. He gets pinched. And while, you know, you had a coffee with Don Joseph on Thursday, so, you know, ergo, you're part of this conspiracy, which, you know, I mean, which are, of course, known in the U.S., which have been the backbreakers of the American underworld, has been the RICO laws, which RICO stands for Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations. Now, RICO covers a wide spectrum of crimes and misdemeanors. So you can get ensnared in all sorts of things, because from a shakedown, you know, that can be multiplied into a criminal conspiracy, and the penalties are substantially higher. And the U.S. hadn't figured out how to use this law, which was enacted in 1970. Until the early 1980s, and that has been, you know, the game changer.
So that was brought in the 1970s, particularly to tackle the mafias and those five families of New York and you know, elsewhere. We're concentrating largely on New York, but obviously there was very strong mafias in Vegas at one point, in Chicago, in Philadelphia, and I'm sure other parts of the US. But they're brought in to tackle them, and maybe like the gangland laws here, it took police a while to work out how to use them. So they started coming in and becoming very useful in the 1980s, early 1980s, when they started to break up those families. But ultimately, it seemed to me that along with those RICO laws, they did need somebody to flip. They did need those insiders. They do actually need mafias, gangs, criminal organizations to implode. And certainly that helps, I think, along the way.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, Joe Messina, who was head of the Bonanno family, I believe, in New York. I mean, you're getting, you know, over the last, you know, 20 years, you're getting mob bosses flipping, you know, by and large to save themselves, of course, but the legislation's so tight and, you know, crime and punishment in the United States is, you know, much more draconian than it is in Ireland or Canada. So, I mean, you're going away for a really, really long time. And, you know, Don Vito's, you know, 79 years old and in failing health. And they're, I mean, they'll tell them, no, you're staying in. You know, you're done. So, you know, you're looking at that thinking, you know, Jesus, I'm going to die in prison. And that makes a very compelling case to flip. You know, there's not much honor in dying at 80 years of age in prison.
And like, absolutely can totally understand that. And that happens here as well, where there aren't such lengthy sentences. The idea of being put away for life or spending three decades in jail, you know, isn't too attractive to many. But it's extraordinary that I think, and it's probably the only place in the world, maybe I'm wrong, but that they can break that omerta, break that sacred supposedly code, give evidence against others, spend their time in prison, but come out and become superstars. I mean, Gravano isn't the only one who's kind of...
Well, Michael Francesi as well. Michael Francesi was head of the Colombo crime family. You know, I've interviewed him as well. And, you know, it's funny, he recently wrote a book that is likening the U.S. government to the mafia. So you know, he's, you know, fairly outspoken about it. But he was a guy with a really good education, and he still ended up going into it. And, you know, he came up with the gas scam, and that was like, you know, a $1 billion scam. From, you know, lifting gas from stations, gas that doesn't arrive or being shorted and then being resold. So, you know, I mean, all these guys, it's like, and I think part of the thing is if it was once a quote unquote honored society and whatnot, it's no longer seen that way by, you know, everyone except the most, you know, starry-eyed wannabe gangsters. And I mean, Sammy told that to me too, because he was a true believer. I mean, he believed in omerta, he believed in the honor of it, and you know, the sacred society and everything. And you know, he came to see that was, you know, false.
But he still believes in the color of money, obviously, and is still making it. I mean, and he's sort of using that interesting past he has, and other people would find it offensive. Many do. And look, the man has admitted to horrendous crimes. But he's still making money, essentially, from that past.
Well, that's, I guess, gets back to my point earlier about, you know, this is a guy, you know, a turn left here, a turn right there, and whatnot, and he's running a very large company. And yeah, I mean, he's, you know, he's exploiting himself, but he does, you know, he does deliver. And you're right, it is, you know, a curious American thing that, you know, somebody like Sammy, I mean, he's a consultant on movies now, and the TV programs, and You know, he apparently has more women writing him than you can shake a stick at. So
I might have to get him on here myself.
Well, I can ask him if he wants to talk to you. I'm sure he would. He loves to chirp, right?
Wouldn't be my usual caliber. But interesting, and to go back, say, to concentrate on New York. So there are some families, I noticed that there were some charges brought against members of the Bonanno and the Genovese families involved again in racketeering and money laundering charges brought against. So we're probably talking, what, fifth, sixth generation of them now. So they're still somewhat active. They're not obviously big players on the scene, but they have been overtaken, surely, by these street gangs, by, you know, these biker gangs. What is there in New York, or is there just so many that there's no major big one concentrated gang?
It's splintered. I mean, a lot, you know, there's MS-13, which, you know, the notoriously violent Central American street gang that's almost like a cult and has, you know, almost elements of the mafia to it, but extremely violent. There's them, but they're not particularly good businessmen. There are, you know, there's the Crips. There, you know, there's the Russian mob. There's, you know, I mean, it's, you know, a massive amount of, you know, it's a mosaic of criminal mm-hmm. enterprise. But, and the mob is still, you know, a major player in New York. I mean, when I lived there, you know, my neighborhood, you know, in Astoria was still a mob neighborhood, but it was also one of the neighborhoods that all through New York's very difficult times when, you know, there were, you know, dozens of murders a week, that was a safe neighborhood. And, you know, that was, you know, known. You don't act up in those neighborhoods. Mm. But yeah, it's the crime world has splintered. And I think, you know, I mean, like a lot of things is that it's, you know, moved more to, with the legalization of gambling and drugs, it's moved more to a lot of more white collar crime, stock fraud, you know, real estate scams and that sort of thing. And, you know, it's interesting that a guy I interviewed, John Binder, who wrote a book on the Chicago outfit. I mean, he says that his view is that the mob fails when it tries to compete with legitimate businesses. And you know, that's the thing is their two biggest streams of money have been essentially cut off by legal.
So, and that is very interesting for us, that the legalization of cannabis. So here, I think cannabis makes up, and certainly mostly in Europe, about 25% of the illegal drug trade, cocaine, heroin, you have tablets, ecstasy, etc., making up the rest of it. But certainly cannabis is still actually one of the largest, like it and cocaine are possibly competing now. But legalizing that has taken, I mean, if we do sort of journalist maths, which is really basic kind of, you know, remedial.
Get it the calculator. Why really? That's four.
But if you took 25% of the illegal, the profits made from illegal drugs away from the drug market, where does that make an actual difference? Can you see a difference in that? Because you're presumably, and again, this is a little bit airy-fairy, but you're presumably saying that that 25% of that money is going into legitimate society. It's been taxed, etc. It's been taken from the hands of the criminals. Does it make less of them, or does it make them more artistic in their endeavors?
Well, I like that turn of phrase, Nicole. But yeah, I think it does make them more artistic. Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, growing up, I mean, no one, you know, had pot, right? It was around and stuff like that. But, you know, now I've got people that you know, give me bags of it. Oh, I grew it in my backyard here. You know, I've got, you know, and it sits in a drawer in my house, and like there's, you know, I couldn't possibly smoke it all. I mean, I don't.
That sounds like my cooking apples coming into September, October, November that grow on the trees, and I'm trying to give them to people.
Yeah, well, no, that's exactly. Oh, you got to test out these sort of thing, and so you multiply that across society. That takes a staggering amount of profit out of that. Now, and that was, you know, I mean, the thing is about cannabis smuggling as well, there's obviously, you know, fewer penalties for that than say cocaine or heroin or pills, and so you've eliminated the profit motive. So they're moving more, you know, which they always were in coke and heroin, but they have to answer to or deal with the Mexican cartels by and large, or the Colombian cartels. To get the heroin and then put it out in the streets. And there's also that apparatus of getting drugs down to the street level, you know, particularly, you know, hard drugs, down to the street level is significantly more difficult as well. And, you know, the places, you know, they still sell in the clubs and all that sort of stuff, but you're way, way, way down the line, you know, to the point where you're dealing with a quote unquote associate rather than a made person. And these guys are all living out in the suburbs as well. I mean, they're...
Is there a black market left in cannabis production? Because that would also be the fear, I think, in places in Europe, that if you legalize it, now, cannabis, again, and you've pointed that out, it's something that somebody can grow in their garden, or if you've green fingers, you can work out how to put it into a glasshouse or how to cultivate it or whatever. We can't do that, obviously, with cocaine. We can't do that with heroin in our environments. But, like, is there still a black market in pot? Or did they literally, has it all settled down and have the kind of the criminals walked away from it?
There is, but it's real, you know, at the low end of the scale. I mean, two blocks from my house, there's a cannabis dispensary. Two blocks that way, there's a cannabis dispensary. Three blocks that way, there's a cannabis dispensary. There's probably, I would say, within a 10-minute walk of my house, half a dozen cannabis dispensaries. So you're going to pop by to the nice clean cannabis dispensary and get what you need? Or are you going to sit in an alley and, you know, buy drugs off some creepy guy named Otto?
Yeah, you've answered it there. And is it a little bit like going into a posh wine shop? Do you go in and you tell them, like, how stoned you want to get it, or how, you know, what flavors you want?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's it. I, you know, I just want to sit and watch the Star Wars canon for 6 hours. Oh, here's what you want. You want this. You know, I don't want to be falling down. Okay. But, you know, and we have the edibles here. Where I grew up, I grew up on the edge of a native reservation. Now, they've, at that particular Tayendanega, they've, you know, embraced the you know, cannabis capitalism wholeheartedly. And it's a tiny place, and there's probably 60 dispensaries, you know, within eyesight of each other. And people come from all over the province to go get their gummies or their weed there. And, you know, it's just all over the place. It's, you know, Smoking Joe's cannabis, you know, like, all kinds of, it's like a massive economy. I don't know whether it's sustainable, whether there's, you know, that many people that want to get stoned, but it's, you know, it's very big, at least, you know, here in Canada right now.
Yeah, that's what I wonder. Will it sort of calm itself down a bit, and will it just settle into the population? Like, you know, not everybody wants to eat meat. Not everybody wants to drink alcohol. Not everybody wants whatever, you know, tofu. You know, will it become, because it's available, is that the nature of humans? We only the, you know, not everybody kind of runs for it. I can only imagine if cannabis was legalized here in Ireland, we'd go completely and utterly bananas for probably about 2 years before we...
Well, I think, you know, it's funny. A friend of mine used to work at the Cadbury factory, one of the Cadbury factories in the UK. And they told them, you know, look, you can eat as much chocolate as you want. And so, you know, after about 4 days, you know, you never want to see it again. And you know, I know guys that are like that in that work in breweries that, that, you know, oh yeah, you know, help yourself anytime, or anything like that, right? And you know, all of a sudden the fridge is full because it's like, ah, no.
Can't look at it anymore. Gorge yourself on it. Anyway, we've slightly gone off. That is an extraordinary nirvana that seems over by you. But anyway, for many people here, I'm sure.
I'll show you around them when you get over.
Perfect. Perfect. We'll just wander around and wander back out again. And but it's legal there. It's different. It's legal. Anyway, the mafia, you know, they are... sort of, they have been, I suppose, when you describe that sort of criminality, it seems to me that in the US, it's a lot more, you're probably further on than we are. a lot has probably happened because of the legalization of cannabis. You have a lot of different cultures there fighting for whatever it is they want. Those gangs, those street gangs you talk about, the Crips, etc., they sound in a much bigger way to some of our violent mobs here who just never make profits. Their actual primary function is violence. So behind the scenes, probably the mob have an experience, the mafias have an experience that many younger groupings would absolutely kill for, because they are the most successful criminal outfit in the world. And when you think of where they came from and how quickly they became that, they almost created their own economy.
Well, yeah, it was, I think the Jewish mob boss Meyer Lansky, famously said, "We're bigger than General Motors," and certainly at that time that would have been true, because they controlled all aspects of the economy. I mean, up till 25 years ago, 26 years ago, they controlled the trucking operations of the New York Post. And at the time they were stealing 50,000 papers a day, because they're stuffing an envelope to the pressman and which is, of course, chaos on the paper itself. But like everything you can possibly think of, bakeries, and unions, right? Yeah, we got a problem. Well, we can shut you down in 5 minutes. I mean, that was the whole thing with the Teamsters, with the trucking, controlling Jimmy Hoffa and his successors, was that, with the snap of a finger, you can shut down the American economy. That's how powerful they are. Now, they can't do that anymore.
And is that why we're still so fascinated by them? We're still talking about them. I mean, you're doing your work still on the mafia, and, in modern society, people are just still lapping up the stories of the mafia. There's still revelations coming out. We still don't know everything about them. They still have their secrets.
Well, the mob, the traditional organized crime, the mafia, it is a fascinating topic, because it's not like, episodic TV. Okay, there's 45 minutes and it's over. It's like an overarching generational story that has not yet, we're in a little bit of the twilight. I think the mafia is always going to be there, but we're in a bit of the twilight. But, you start looking at things now. Well, how did we get here to there, and you see the family connections, and this guy did that, and he finked on so and so. And I mean, I also recently wrote about Philadelphia and Chicago, and these, in a lot of ways, they're the quintessential American stories. Everything we've come to know, who watched the United States, who've lived there, who've studied it, and that sort of stuff, is that the mafia is emblematic of the whole American ethos, that grab the opportunity by the throat, the American dream, except packing a gun. Now, nowadays, if you and I were to sit down and say, okay, Nicola, let's form our criminal enterprise, and the question is, are we going to do it with a computer or a gun? Well, that's a no-brainer, right? And that's something where they haven't jumped into, because part of the reason is, as I said, is the mafia gene pool is greatly diminished. Whereas, you could say 50, 60, 70 years ago that, these were men of vision. I mean, a criminal vision, granted, but the fixing of the fights, the point shaving on basketball games, and different things like that. I mean, they're very, ingenious scams, but they've had their day as well.
For sure. And I suppose finally, Brad, you talk about that, the American dream, and at the heart of that really is greed, whether we like it or not, it is that. And that's what drove the mafia. And drove them to kill, and drove them to, get involved with and muscle their way in on everywhere that there was money to be made. But where is the money? I mean, can you identify it now? Has it traveled down the generations? Is it within certain families? You know, is it, has it been legitimized, and have generations and generations of, I suppose, Italian Americans benefited from that?
Oh, I think a lot of people have benefited from the mafia, particularly in the Italian American community, and that's not a stain on them. You know, an immigrant to, you know, North America, it's can be a very hard go, and, you know, particularly to the United States, because it doesn't have the social safety net. So you have, it's very cutthroat. So you have to do whatever you can to get a leg up or you sink. And that's what it is. But ironically, it's, you know, I don't want to be glib about this, you know, given the violence and whatnot, but it is a great American success story. It's in a lot of ways, it's mission accomplished. You know, dad, you know, was a loan shark and gambler and all this sort of stuff, and involved in myriad underworld schemes, right? Well, what's he do? He sends his son to, you know, Harvard to become a lawyer. And you know that that lawyer's kids are never going to get involved. I mean, here in Canada, a guy, unfortunately, he got murdered, but they had him on tape saying, you know, he was the son of a mobster here. And, you know, he got asked, you know, did he want to become a made member of the family. He's got on tape, you know, God, no, why would I want to do that? Like, you know, like, that's crazy. So that's the thing too, is, and so, you know, the smart kids have left.
Even in ordinary society, in legitimate society, whatever you'd call it, I think the next generation looks on the one that went before them as aliens. I think we see that all the time with our own kids and with our own parents. You know, I suppose things can change so vastly, and you know, out of all that murder and mayhem, if some things have changed for the better, that's the least we can, I suppose, walk away with.
That's the silver lining inside the cloud, I think. And you know, I mean, it seemed things, but then, you know, there's John Gotti was quoted when he was sent to prison, is that they're going to miss John Gotti, and there's an element of truth to that, just in that there was a level of organization and oversight on all these neighborhoods and criminal activities and things like that. I mean, you know, there were certain things you didn't do. There was, you know, code, if you'll have it, or rules. And now there doesn't appear to be any rules. You know, you didn't hit a cop, you didn't hit a journalist, you know, you shut up, you know, but that's all gone. That's a lost world.
Despite the presence of that vast Atlantic Ocean between our nation and yours, it sounds as if things are pretty much the same no matter where you are. So, Brad Hunter, thank you very much.
Thanks, Nicola. You take care of yourself.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com, produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. Research assistant is Clodagh Meaney. If you like this show and love true crime, leave us a review, or why not download the free SundayWorld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.